Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Kevin.
It's just us again.
Just us. Everyone wants the rest of the guys back. We see it in the reviews, and I just want to say I want them too. We all want them.
Everybody's busy, obviously. We're all running companies. I don't know. I find this very enjoyable and I learn a lot. That's why I kind of make sure that I make time every week to do it. While still running a company, I think it's a positive. I don't do any investing or anything like that. This is kind of my only thing outside of running the company that I do and having a family.
And if folks share the podcast and leave us more reviews and,
Yes.
tell all their friends, we will get the other folks back because they're waiting for it to blow up.
Yes, and more really cool guests, which we have some more coming
We
on.
do have some good ones
Yes.
in
Yes.
store.
Cool. So I think we should probably start. So what's the date today? We're recording this November 7th. November 6th was basically OpenAI's coming out. Well, not I guess probably their second or third coming out party, which they did. I guess it was
It
what
was
their
their
dev
first
day.
developer event.
Yeah. Do you want to take a stab at what they kind of announced and why it's like interesting people should be actually as you're building a company or an employee, why it matters?
Well, I'm going to butcher it. So I will give a
Cool.
shout out to TechCrunch, who wrote a good article, Everything Announced at OpenAI's First Developer Event. But I think the TLDR is people are really excited about a
Yeah.
lot of the new capabilities. And also, I think they killed a lot of startups in the process of these announcements,
Yeah.
people that were building these things. And then OpenAI just released them all or made it much easier for folks to do it themselves. So those were my two like takeaways of what everyone is saying about it. Like one, it's really exciting, but two, like a bunch of venture-backed startups just got decimated.
Yeah, it's really tough. So let's touch on like the platform risk and like if you are going and building something on top of a platform, like we could take this back to like if you think of all of the different platform switch kind of shifts and people building on them, there's lots of examples of people riding them really high. So I think back to like Facebook's days where you had like Zynga. Like Zynga would not have existed without riding Facebook's like platform. And then but also that really when Facebook kind of clamped down on a lot of, I think Zynga was spamming a lot of people and all that kind of stuff. They clamped down on that and it really hampered them. But they were able to get their company to a sizable a really sizable size that they were able to still and they're still public to this day, still make a business out of it. But there's so many examples from Facebook, the App Store, just like looking down the list, Windows, right? Like Windows making the search browser, that they made their own browser and basically kind of they didn't totally lock everybody out, but they made their own browser. Or Google being like the default and in all of the search engine and all of these different things. Like if you're building on a platform, you're looking for a platform for either a distribution, there's tons of risk with like the actual platform building what you're doing. And I think it's the same thing with OpenAI. And this is what's going to happen, and it's going to continue happening with OpenAI and other platforms that come up. What are your thoughts on this,
Yeah,
Sarah?
I agree. I mean, it seems like one of their announcements is this like GPT store. So you
Yes,
can
like an app
create your
store.
own chat GPTs that are more specific use cases, I
Yeah,
guess,
yep.
and put them on the store, which is like, I guess, the Apple App Store move. I think the thing that's not clear to me is like how the monetization works. Which I think is a key piece, like to be more like Apple and less like Facebook. Like you need a model that works for both the platform, in this case OpenAI, as well as the creators
Yeah.
to both benefit. And when you don't have that, you have a lot of risk. Like either, Facebook is absorbing all the value, or
Right.
they're leaking too much value, and they're going to shut down their creators, or they could just end up building the things that are most lucrative themselves,
yep,
and reap all the benefits. So I feel like, you know, the Apple App Store is like the example of this done right. There's not a ton of other examples of doing this well and having it actually work and become a massive, massive business for everyone involved. I mean, not just the App Store is not just a massive business for Apple. It's a massive business for all these businesses that are built on top of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's extremely, exceedingly rare. So it'll be interesting, like, what other, you know, App Stores have reached anywhere near that kind of scale. Nothing's really worked out.
Yeah, not that scale. I definitely, there's definitely a few shout outs. Like, I think that Slack is one. They're definitely smaller. I'd say that Shopify is actually a lot bigger. They allow, like, Klaviyo was the first company that is, like, wholly reliant on Shopify sellers, and they just went public, and they're worth like $8 billion or something like that. And I think that's their market cap. So there's lots of examples there. But also, I think, like, anybody, and this is also why, like, when you're in like a pitch, VCs, they get very skittish over platform risks. Mm-hmm. As far you'll get that question if you're overly reliant on a certain platform, like, are they going to go and build it themselves? Typically, like, Apple does this too, right? Like, you think about Apple Music versus Shopify or Spotify. Sorry, I guess Shopify and Spotify mix.
I know, I always mix.
Yeah. So, like, that is a Apple has actually a massive advantage, like, they're able to, they basically just call them the same service. I prefer Spotify, but, like, Apple's able to not charge. They were charging in Spotify, I think, 30% if you were going to actually subscribe to. And now I think on Spotify, they've now removed the capability for you to pay in app, but Apple doesn't not. So they naturally have like a 30% cost advantage in like the world of music, where the royalties and it's a pretty slim margin business. So that's a pretty big leg up. So you definitely do need to worry about like platform risk, no matter where you're building. If you're building an AI company and you're worried about OpenAI, if you're heavily reliant on some sort of technology to provide, like, you're building on top of it, or you're a wrapper on it, or you're in an app store, you really need to have a point of view on like why you're going to be a lot better. I don't know, for some reason, like, TweetDeck kind of sticks out at me. Were you ever, I know you were obviously an employee at Twitter, and I don't know, were you ever a user of TweetDeck? And I think is it dead now?
I feel like it's still, so at one point Twitter acquired it, but all the other apps got like shut down.
Right.
So that was run independently for a while. I feel like, well, who knows what's going on now. But I feel like they kept it running for a good amount of time, and possibly is still running, but that all the other third party apps,
they've killed them.
Were killed. You know, this was pre Elon.
Yeah.
So you couldn't build your own like client that did the same thing as Twitter because they could not monetize that.
Right.
In the same way that they could monetize the owned and operated apps. So I think that's like the thing I would look for if I were investing a lot of time in building on top of a new platform, is like, what is the monetization to the platform and then to me? And like, is this going to long term be sustainable for both? I remember when like everyone had to build like an Alexa skill and like that was the latest craze.
Yeah.
And I was just, always like,
where is that now?
Where, like, are people really going to search for childcare like that way? Do we really need to? And I was just like, it's just yet one more thing to build.
Yeah.
And so we never ended up doing it. But like, there was a time period, I'm not going crazy, when like every investor in the world was like, where's your Alexa integration?
Every hype cycle has this. Do you remember the chatbot like hype cycle as well?
So I mean, the whole ChatGPT thing is hysterical to me, because when we were starting Winnie 8 years ago and raising funding, we had investors turn us down because they said they were only chatbot investors. So they may have been just really ahead of their time.
Well, I think, I'd probably say no. I think that was I still am very iffy on the actual chat interface. I think ChatGPT is like an interesting for some people. I think the overlying technology is really cool. Like
right.
That's actually provides value. But like the chat interface, like I just, maybe I'm older and maybe the younger generations like that. They prefer it more than like an actual like UI design or something like that. I never really got the chat interface. I still don't. I'd rather have like actual interfaces that you click and drag things and all of these different types of stuff. So I never really got that. But yeah, we always go through this hype cycle, and it's just investors are looking for, they're looking for those outside returns. So they want to see how you're going to integrate into this or take advantage of this or become one of these companies, because usually there's going to be a few. And I think I think I was listening to some podcast. I can't remember if it was like 20 VC or somebody, but one famous investor is like, you basically, there's like two generational companies like per year. And it's like your job as a VC to get in one. So that means just placing a lot of bets on a lot of like, you don't know who actually is going to become this, but like those are the ones that actually return the funds. So you need to be really careful. I think that you absolutely can build on top of platforms like Klaviyo. They're an email and SMS platform for Shopify stores specifically. I think 80% of the revenue is, or 90% of the revenue is from Shopify stores. So if Shopify came up with a better email client, they could offer it for a lot cheaper because they already have the customers. That's a really big risk. But they obviously had some point of view. Maybe they're ahead of something. I don't know why they're so much better than all the other alternatives. But I think if you have that, you can definitely make it work. But I think concentrating a lot of your, like, it's just really risky. Also, at the same time, it's really risky to bet on a few like really large customers. So I remember reading the Twilio S1, and I think they still get a lot of flack for this. They had, I think, wasn't it something like crazy, like 60% of their revenue was from WhatsApp or something like that?
Oh, wow.
It was something crazy like that. And it's just like, you want to, when you're thinking about like what area you want to start in and like what type of customers you want to go after, I think like you need to have a really unique point of view, not be overly reliant on like one company. And that could be meaning your, like your supplier or your distribution channels or like a single customer or something like this. Like they're just like, there's only like three or four customers out there like this. And if you, it like, that's the total addressable market. I think kind of looking at de-risking your what you're building, like try to control as many things as you possibly can. Try to have your own distribution channels. Try to have a product that's really, really unique. Try to make sure it's 10 times better. I think those are all things that like you should be doing if you're looking to build a venture-backed company. But like you said, as we started, like, yeah, there's a lot of companies that just probably have to now, they probably were well-funded, and then they're going to have to think of something else to do in the AI space right now.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, anything where you're heavily concentrated, even if it's going really well, it's a good idea to diversify and de-risk that, even if that's not going to be your main channel.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, one marketing channel you're heavily reliant on, it's like, it's something we think about a lot in, you know, being so reliant on SEO, for example. Like,
right.
What are
that's a great point.
Second
yeah.
channels that we're investing in, not because we necessarily think that in the short term they'll be bigger than SEO as a channel for us, but we need to de-risk like being so reliant on one thing.
Yeah. Here's some other examples that just kind of pop in my head. Like SEO, obviously you rely on Google, and then Google can basically just build products on top of you. So great examples would be Yelp. Like, yeah. And I know that the CEO, Jeremy Stoppelman or something.
Yeah, Jeremy Stoppelman.
Yeah, I think he definitely either sued Google or he was trying to bring up antitrust.
Yeah,
stuff
like
against
very publicly,
them.
Against Google and antitrust
because what essentially Google did is that they owned searching, and Yelp was able to, before Google had any like reviews on places or restaurants or anything like that, they Yelp would come up and it would be basically like whoever produces the best content is going to go to the very top of the list. And then all of a sudden Google kind of built out their maps functionality and then also their places. And now there's reviews and you could even reserve tables and they're kind of taking even like OpenTable out a little bit somewhat. I think OpenTable is still kind of winning. But like being Thumbtack's another example, like Google hasn't replaced them, but I know like that was a major Thumbtack is for anybody that doesn't know what they are. They're a place that you could go and find like pros to do like odd jobs or something like that, like a plumber or something like that. And they relied so much on like SEO to like fund their distribution. And like from investors, they don't really like that a lot, but also it makes sense because if you're over reliant on and you don't properly de-risk your distribution, you do risk like what happens if somebody's better at SEO or what happens if Google comes along and just is now the number one top ranked product with like Google Maps and their reviews and all that, which took a huge hit. I think people definitely need to really think about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Yelp is more of a success story in that, like, look, they're still around today and still a huge brand. I think they built brand as a big channel.
Yeah.
People love to shit on Yelp, but like they're huge. And
$3 billion market cap.
To Yelp, like, oh, are you just building Yelp for daycare? And I'm like, well, that's actually a pretty sizable business. But I think Thumbtack is like, they didn't build a brand. Like, I don't know that, you know, you just had to tell people what Thumbtack is. Everyone knows what Yelp is. So I think they did a worse job of diversifying than.
Yeah, it's tough because you early days, you're looking for anything that you could get distribution off of. But then what do you do? Like for Yelp, how are they like they definitely had quite a few years head start on Google. But like, what can they do now besides complaining? And also, I would say like for how much like Google says that they're not a monopoly, they definitely are in search.
Oh, yeah. Google, I mean, I am on the side of Yelp as far as like antitrust concerns, and it's anti-competitive when they can just promote their own thing at the top. So I agree that's a real concern, and it, you know, it hurts innovation if other products can't get off the ground by being the best, and you're always going to lose to whatever Google's in-house product is. That's a concern.
And also for anything else too, like you think of like other types of companies that like in SaaS, there's a lot of like bundling that goes on and you see that. So a great example is like Slack versus Teams, right? Like Slack essentially had to sell to Salesforce because they were Teams was being, which is a Microsoft product, it was being bundled with like just Microsoft's whole suite, and it was a fraction of the cost, and or maybe even free, I don't even know. But like the bundling piece is something you definitely need to make sure that, again, I think it's like, what's your, we've talked about this before, but like, what's your moat? And like, you really need to lean into that and just continue going after that. Or else you are just going to be like a product and you're just going to find it to be impossible to compete, which I'm not a Teams user. I don't know. Have you ever used Teams before?
I mean, just when someone sends me a link and I have to join their version of a Zoom call.
Right. Same thing goes with like Google, Google Video or Google Meets versus like Zoom, right? Like you definitely argue that like, because Google's Meets comes for free, and like if you use G Suite, like they just bundle it for free, so that's a really big risk for Zoom. But I think how Zoom has kind of came out of that, they just continue to, I use it because it's just more reliable than Google Meets. I like some of, I don't know, and maybe it's just like embedded in more products a little better, I don't know. I use Calendly and it just kind of works, but you definitely need to kind of worry about like and build like a real business, build something that is really defensible if you're trying to build a truly like venture scale business.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, okay, there's lots of other outcomes for companies out there that are not, like selling to Salesforce, for example. And Slack made out fine.
Yeah. That is true. Slack just announced that they're getting a new CEO. So they, you know, the founder, Stuart, he already left, but yes, then they replaced it with this woman, Lydian, who I think was at Lydian Jones, who was
at Salesforce.
Salesforce.
Yeah.
She's going to Bumble as the CEO.
Yes.
And TBD who Slack's new CEO will be.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Slack inside a larger company, and does it get the same care and attention now that the founders obviously left, and Salesforce is just like a juggernaut, and it's like Slack is just such a small percentage of the revenue.
I mean, I feel like they kind of missed the boat, or like they're behind the curve on AI. Like it was such an obvious, like I'm sure they have a million like add-ons in their developer ecosystem, but I haven't taken the time to like learn those things. But it seemed like such an obvious one to me that they could have included AI more natively. Like I open Slack every day to do my work. It felt like AI could have been more natively incorporated, and they just haven't done any of that yet. So it's been surprising. Like, I feel like that's somewhere like the DNA is like, they're probably really focused on sales and Salesforce.
Yeah.
And they don't have the DNA of like a small innovative company that's like led by product and engineering anymore.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? Like, this is kind of even maybe like kind of the part of the innovator's dilemma, right? Yeah. Like, once you're like, you worked at Twitter, right? Like, you could definitely argue that Twitter should have done a lot more than it did. And maybe this kind of goes into one of the other topics that we were talking about before, but like, how hard is it to like truly innovate in such a ginormous company?
Yeah, I think it's really, really hard. And I think this is where, you know, small teams and startups can really win, is like, it's so hard to innovate in a big company, especially if you have metrics to hit and you're public and
yeah,
you can't take the long view because every quarter you have to report. I just imagine it. And I know from like working at big companies, from working at Twitter and Google, which was even bigger, it's like everyone has a role to play. You right. are narrowly in this box. If you're, innovation is encroaching on someone else's area that they own, things can also get very political because they don't right. want to give up ownership. That's how they're growing their career and their salary. So you have to only innovate within the confines of like not stepping on other people's toes. Or if your innovation is beyond that, you're spending a lot of time kind of navigating the political environment of like, you know, become part of my innovation and let's all present it together and let's get buy-in. And all that stuff really takes away from the actual building and the actual work of coming up with an amazing product. So I do think it's really, really, really hard to innovate at large companies. So much easier for small teams.
Right.
And that's where like the true advantage is.
Yeah. And you just don't have a lot of the, well, also, like a lot of the people, you're not really paid to take big risks, right? Yeah. There's very few cultures out there that have been able to build this into the DNA of the company. I'd say probably Amazon is one that's done a good job. Microsoft has been one. They continue to come out with like new product lines, but you're kind of like, you're at a big company and you kind of, most people want to climb the ladder and make like a lot of money and have like a good work-life balance and all of that stuff. And like, you're just not, you're probably rewarded more for just like doing what exactly you're told and making sure you're managing up, and versus like taking big risks for most of the time, because everybody's just kind of worried that they're going to screw up something. And it's really hard to build that into culture. I don't know if you say that, was that like that at Twitter?
Yeah. I mean, I also think part of innovation is like iterating, and you don't always, you can't always see the full picture and the full story as you're working on it. And so I even see, like, with our small team, you know, we'll try something and it won't exactly work as we planned. And then we'll be like, okay, let's try this other thing. And sometimes, like, people are like, wait a minute. But our strategy was this, and now this other thing is happening. Like, are we sure? And they get really, like, nervous. And I'm like, okay, take a step back here. Like, yes, our strategy was this, but it didn't work. And so now we have to do this. And, like, here's how it all fits together. And here's the story. And I end up, you know, communicating, even for our small team, like, it's a lot of, you know, just getting everyone on the same page. So that just gets magnified by so many people that when you start to make these, like, you know, you're testing things and you're moving quickly and you're testing something else, like, people get really nervous. They're like, wait a minute. Like, we said we were doing this thing and now we're doing this thing. Are we sure? Am I going to lose my job? Am I doing the wrong thing? Is this company, like, does anyone know what they're doing? And I think that, like, I saw so much of that at a large company. It's such a relief to have a small team. But I even see, you know, when it's beyond just the few people working on the problem, you start to spend a lot of cycles just communicating.
Yeah.
Getting everyone on the same page.
Yeah. And also continuously repeating, like, what your mission is. And then also just, like, repeating, like, that it's a, like, we want people to try here. And you kind of sound like a broken record. And that's kind of your job, is, like, the CEO is, like, you're setting, obviously, the vision and everything. And you want to give people the ability to try things and fail. And, like, you need to reiterate that a lot, because especially when you start getting customers and you're scaling that, people are very, like, afraid of losing them. And, like, I constantly need to remind our team, like, it's, we're going to churn customers. Like, if we're not churning customers, we're probably not moving fast enough. And, like, we're not going to be a product. No product is, like, a perfect fit for everybody. And for us, we have so many different types of customers and sizes and all that. And we can't build for everybody. Like, this is impossible. And so if everybody's worried about, like, this one person left, or, like, these few other the companies that's, like, we weren't a great fit, they leave, like, you need to remind people, it's like, no, that's fine. That's okay. Like, let's continue innovating on like, where we think our ideal customer is, what their pain points are, and get more of those. And you just kind of need to be, like, a broken record and continue to tell people that. And, like, because I think inherently in human nature, people just don't want to screw up. But if you let them know that it's okay to fail over and over again and beat that into the culture, I think that's possibly the way that you do it. But I don't know. My last company was 300 people, and most of them were just executing. I've never run a massive company, like, and I think it's really tough to create that into your culture and have it scale. Like, it's scaled into, what are some other good examples between Microsoft and, well, I guess Google to a certain extent has tried a lot of different stuff.
I mean, I think when I've seen big companies work well or better is, like, when there are clear areas of ownership and you can innovate within that area, and those areas make sense. So, like, Twitter at some points would organize by, like objective, like, there's a growth team and there's a revenue team, and that doesn't exactly work because the growth team ends up, like, having all these ideas for growth that touch everyone's stuff. And then everyone gets upset and everyone hates the growth team. And the growth team feels like they can't do their job. And it's just a drama. Versus, like, if you say, hey, this team, you own the onboarding flow. Like, that's yours. Everything about creating an account, go wild and crazy with it. I think that gives teams more space to innovate. If they know, like, this is the thing I own, I can, you know, rebuild it, I can change everything about it, it doesn't really have to work with the rest of the product.
Right.
And I have room to innovate. That's when I've seen some of the most innovative stuff happen. There's always, you know, coordination overhead because of the growth. If the onboarding team goes off and builds an onboarding flow in, you know, purple, but the rest of the products in blue, got to kind of make it all match. But I feel like when you have those like clear guardrails of areas of the product that you own, things work a little better.
Yep.
And those need to be large enough that you actually have space to do something meaningful. I think, you know, there's some companies, some really large companies that I won't name, but, you know, are maybe trillion-dollar companies where, like, you see people with, like, really small areas of ownership. And you just have to wonder, like, how much can they really affect change?
They can't. Let's just be clear here.
Yeah.
And we're talking about Facebook. We're talking about, come on, like, the big companies that you have such a small, like, little piece, and it may not even see the light of day.
Yeah.
And that's also what, like, I would never. So the beginning of my career, I worked for big companies as well, just as an engineer. And yeah, like, a lot of the stuff that I worked on, like, it didn't see the light of day at all. And that is, like, if you're an actual builder, like, that's why I wanted to start my own company. So yeah. I can, like, and, like, actually.
They hire some really talented people at these really big companies. But, like, I just have to wonder, like, are these people actually able to make an impact, especially if they're in, like, an individual contributor role? Like, how much can they really do with what they, you know, you own one pixel of one screen.
Right.
So, that's why I love working at a startup, having a small team. And, like, it's hard to imagine, like, what a few thousand person Winnie would look like, because it's hard to imagine I would want to lead that size team even.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe you could be doing a lot of more revenue with a lot smaller team due to AI though.
Yep.
That's the
I like computers better than people.
Yeah. I'm curious. I don't know. This has popped in my head, but do you have a lot of friends? Like not that question.
You have a lot of friends? No, the answer is no.
Okay. No, do you have a lot of friends or previous peers or whatever that they work at big companies and they just, like, complain nonstop and they are, like, too scared to, like, join a small startup or, like, start something of their own?
Yeah. I mean, like,
but they complain all the time.
I mean, I won't speak for my husband, but, like, he was at Google for many years, like 12 plus years. And, like, it's not that he complained, but, like, it was because he's not much of a complainer. But, like, I could just see, like, it just sucked the life out of him.
Right.
Especially, you know, towards the end, like, he would just work so hard for this company that never, like, gave anything back to him. Like, he would stay up all night preparing for a meeting, and then, like, the meeting would just get canceled.
Yeah.
And it was, like, the most important meeting, and then it would just be like, oh no, they changed their mind. Like, I just, like, couldn't imagine. I mean, of course that can happen anywhere, but, like, that just seemed to happen frequently.
Right.
And it just took everything out of him. I mean, he traveled to developing countries constantly. Like, they worked him to death.
Right.
And yeah, like, I couldn't imagine doing that for so long. And I'm glad he doesn't anymore, because I think it was just not compatible with having a family. But it was just amazing to see, like, the lack of autonomy, the hard work he had to do. You know, they pay well, but is it really worth it?
Yeah. And also, like, you can get paid also well in a Series B startup, relatively well. Obviously, like, if you're talking about, like, an engineer or, like, a director or VP, like, you're probably a large public company, you're looking at, like, probably $250,000 to $1 million in salaries and stock options a year. So you definitely get a lot more. But, like, some of these startups, like, they definitely, you have to compete a little bit. So I'd say it definitely would be in the lower end, but, like, for some of these more senior VPs, like, you could probably get, like, $300,000 or something like that for, like, a Series B, C company to be running all of that. And you could have started out at the startup, like, in the very ground floor and not knowing anything and work your way up. I really, I wish, and I said this last episode, like, if I could do everything over again, I would have skipped the big company phase and just went directly to startups. And obviously, like, I want to found companies, and not everybody wants to found them, but I think it's just so much, like, so much more fun. You learn so much more than, like, a small companies. And, like, you could go, and if you don't want to take the risk, you could stay at, like, the Series B companies that have found product market fit, but, like, you still do have an impact versus, like, the really big public companies where you just don't. Like, I remember my times at, like, Boeing, and I worked for a space company in Canada, and it was just, like, just the amount of output. Like, I would just look forward to just getting off work, and I just didn't really give a shit. And, like, I didn't learn hardly anything there. I did everything on the side, and I had side businesses and stuff like that. And it just, like, took so much out of me. And I think also what's going to happen is, like, obviously there's, like, we have Google, that some people actually argue that Google is now at a risk due to AI. I think that there definitely will always be big companies, but, like, if you look back decades, like, it's continuously these companies get disrupted by the next biggest one. I think those cycles, given how fast technology is moving, is going to be faster and faster and faster. And there's going to be, my viewpoint is that there's going to be a lot more smaller companies, given just how much more leverage that you have. Like even showing what, like, when Elon came and took over Twitter, they cut down, how much staff do they have before? It was, like,
they had thousands, but I don't remember what he cut and what they have now.
They have, like, 1,500 people, but, like, that, and I think, I don't know if they were just able to just cut out a lot of, like, the redundancy or whatever, but, like, that's the next generation of companies that are getting built. And I think that that's way more exciting than going and joining, like, a Facebook or a Google or something like that. You still probably you're able to, like, have some sort of impact. But I think personally, like, you learn way more in a startup than you would even at, like, a pre-IPO or IPO company. Where I was kind of going at this is that I have so many friends that have been founders before, and I don't know if it's, like, some people, as you get older, your risk, it's kind of, like, it decreases. It definitely is not for me, but I just see that they're just, like, they're trading in their autonomy for, like, yeah, a good paycheck, but they're also living in the Bay Area. So it's like, it's like, you're going to live in a fine house, but, like, you hate your job, you hate your boss, you're constantly doing reorgs and all this shit. You're not actually building stuff. I want to, like, shake those people and be like, just fucking join a startup, like, join my company. Like, why the fuck not? Like, the upside is big, or go build something yourself. Like, you're like, you founded something before. There's lots of VCs out there that are willing to fund you. And it's just really frustrating because you see so much talent get sucked up by these companies that just don't really turn out really much of anything outside of their core product. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it always amazes me whenever we do partnerships or even, like, our customers, like, just how many people are on the other side, how many people these other companies have. And then it's, like, me showing up, there's a lot of, it seems like there's some redundancy in these businesses. And I just can't figure out why a lot of them still operate this way.
Like, yeah,
it seems so obvious that it would slow things down to have multiple people performing the same job, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I got a question for you. As far as, like, this next generation, so what, Gen Z, I guess, I've read, like, a lot of reports on, like, they prefer, like, work-life balance is, like, way more important than, like, the millennials that are used to, like, cranking, like, long hours, and they really, like, take their job really seriously, or versus, like, millennials seem to, and there's also been a lot of, I don't know if you've seen some of the TikToks and stuff like that have been out there that are probably unfairly criticizing some people that are just, like, complaining about, like, I got to go into work and I got to go to an office, something like that. What do you think, like, now that you're kind of like in the middle of your career, I would say. And you could obviously like, I'm assuming, right? What would you think?
I feel like I'm starting out, but it's crazy. I'm like, I guess 16 years into like full-time.
Yeah, that's almost an adult year career. Would you rather, like, when you're building a company, would you rather like hire super young people or like people that have experience that are like your age, your seniority, all of that? Like if you're assembling a startup with all you know now.
Yeah. So I actually don't think we have any Gen Zers at Winnie. Not because I am opposed to it. I just, you know, we've kind of naturally attracted more experienced workers.
Yeah.
You know, we're remote. And I think it's just, we don't have a lot of management. Not a lot of overhead. Everyone has a really wide scope. There's a lot of ambiguity in everyone's job. Like,
right.
No one really has a defined, some people have some defined things they like must do, but then there's a lot of open time and space to be like, just make yourself valuable.
Right.
So I think that just lends itself to people with more experience. I am personally, though, like confused by all these trends around Gen Z, because I see with my own kids that like their lives and what they have to do is like a million times more stressful than mine ever was. Like I just took my daughter to like soccer tryouts last night, and it was like I was almost in tears. Like it was so intense to like watch.
Yeah.
And she's 8, and like they were like screaming at them like a military operation, and like the girls were all doing it and listening, and like, I mean, these kids were like insane. They were really good at soccer and really good listeners, and I was just like, wow, like I could not imagine doing that at 8, and like just seeing how my daughter like handled herself, I was just like, wow. She was like yelled at and for doing the thing wrong, and she was just like boom, like just listened right away, caught right. on, and like, so that seems like at odds with what I'm hearing about Gen Z of like they don't want to work hard and they want a lot of balance, or maybe they're getting so burnt out earlier on.
Yeah.
Because I just see like kids these days like have a lot on their plate, and it just seems so much more intense than it ever was for me as a kid.
Right.
Maybe that's like a factor of where my kids are growing up in the Bay Area.
I was going to ask you. Yeah.
But I grew up, you know, in the suburbs of Philadelphia where things were pretty intense too.
Were they?
You know, I went to a top public high school that is known for being really, really good in the state of Pennsylvania. So like, I don't know, like it just, it's, I don't know where, why, I'm sure there's been a million analyses of it, but it seems like things have only gotten harder and more intense at an earlier age, like college admissions, for example. It's so hard to get into college now.
Right.
So much harder than it ever was when I was applying for college. Like you just needed good grades, a strong like story about your extracurriculars. Now you need to like found a company or a nonprofit to get into college. Even like the California state schools are like impossible to get into. So it's really changed. I think there's a lot of intensity earlier on. I think the internet has like opened up all these opportunities. So people have really taken advantage of that earlier on. So I'm actually surprised to hear that like Gen Z is so, chill about. I would think that would produce like hardcore workers.
I would think so too, and I do question that too. So I grew up in Canada and it was not like that at all. Like it was not competitive at all. Like most of my friends are still there. I think every single one of them, nobody has even moved from the city that they went or more or less like within like 50 miles or something that they grew up in. And they didn't even, most of them didn't go to like, post-secondary school at all. And a lot of them went into trades and all of that. And I think that is a very stark difference from just the US in general.
Right.
I think there is like, I think in the world, right? It's like kind of people come here and they want to live the American dream. And I think that's why it attracts so many immigrants. That's why I moved here. And I also, I moved to like specifically like to San Francisco because I was like, this is where it's even more competitive and you could build something even more big. And I was just very ambitious. So I do wonder so definitely the U.S. is way more competitive than I would say probably, and I'll just anecdotally, like even Europe as well. I do wonder if it is just like the where we do live, because I do find, because my oldest is now 6, and I'm even seeing some of this kind of like very competitive sports stuff, and I'm like, this is kind of crazy. And he's in a public school, I've never seen that. I didn't have that growing up. But then you have, on the other side, it's like you have people who just don't, they want to like take shortcuts. And maybe we just hear like the bad stuff. I can't say that I've seen, no, I know. Actually, I actually did. So at Chip, when we were scaling up, like when we got to like the Series B and it was like close to 100 people like in office, like those are like the kind of the tech workers, we would have people that would just like do the minimum amount of work, and then they would just like stay to vest 1 to 2 years, and then they'd be out, and they'd be trying to kind of diversify and try to just get rich and like off the net, off the stock options, and then they go and to another company. And so they're not really like, their heart really isn't in it, and they don't necessarily want to work that hard, but they do want a lot of the payoff for that. So I definitely did see that firsthand. And that also was in like San Francisco, which is extremely competitive. So I definitely do see that, but it definitely does seem like the newer generations, but maybe this is amplified by social media more than we just see these odd cases, but it definitely is not my generation. Like I'm the same with you. We've hired probably average age is mid to late 30s in our company. And like everybody works their fucking ass off.
So Gen Z, I'm just looking it up. It's people born in 1997 to 2012. So that would make them like the oldest are 26.
Yep.
And the youngest, I guess, are 11.
Right.
That's like, I don't have a lot of exposure to that age group because my kids are just slightly. So I don't know what the next generation is, but that's like, I think the generation I understand the best. And then millennial, which I am.
You're right. Same.
And most of our employees are, or they're actually older. They're Gen X. So I feel like Gen Z is like such a mystery to me, but it's a generation I'm really going to have to learn, because when I started Winnie, it was all the millennials becoming parents. Now it's going to start to be Gen Z.
Yeah.
You know, some are parents, but 26 is like those are the oldest. So they're starting to become parents. And I'm really going to have to understand this demographic well. So maybe we can get a Gen Z expert on the pod.
Yeah.
A Gen Z founder. Tell us about Gen Z.
There's always exceptions to the rule. There still are like mid-20s starting like these companies and they're working their ass off and all of that. Like there's exceptions to every single rule. Did you want to, I'm curious, we talked about this before we started, and I've never worked for like a really big modern tech company. Like I worked for like as a software engineer, like older companies, but like you were at Twitter in San Francisco, working for a big company. You joined them when they're how many employees?
We're like a little over 200 employees when I joined. 200
employees. So we're like really early on. And you mentioned the one of the other times that you had to unlearn a lot of the stuff you learned there. And so for people that are listening, that you probably, if you're listening, you're either a founder or you're potentially want to be a founder, or you just want to learn about startups. But like, can you tell us more about like what you had to unlearn from like a big company like that and how it doesn't apply to like a really small startup?
Yeah. So first of all, like there was a lot that I learned that was really great and a lot of great connections that I made. So definitely appreciate my time at a really fast growing company. But I think one of the big things I had to unlearn was like the experimentation. Twitter had a very heavy, like, let's A-B test everything to death before we launch it. And like layers and layers of analysis and approvals. And sometimes like the metrics just wouldn't like be right. Like the A-B test just wasn't, not everything can be A-B tested, or you don't capture like a lot of the second or third order effects of doing something. So like, yeah, if you make a button like bright and flashing, more people will click on it. And so your A-B tests may show good results, but then, you know, people may start hating your product and churn from it over time because it's too loud or whatever. So that I had to unlearn that like A-B tests were the answer to everything. Yeah. And you just have to have product intuition and make decisions and then be able to look at the impact kind of longer term and over time without perfect data.
Yeah.
And that like kind of that faster iteration was actually better in a startup. So I think that was a big area. The other thing was like the idea of like you build it, you launch it, you iterate, like that doesn't really apply in a startup because you have to sell the thing. Like,
right.
You can't just count on like millions of people using it. The way more important step is like making sure people will use it. And ideally you do that in advance of building it. You have a pretty good sense people will use it. So that whole like sales, like Twitter, you know, and Google too, to some extent, it was just like build a product people love, get usage, and then like someone else will figure out the monetization that you really have to unlearn. Working in a startup because the whole thing is, can you sell it?
Yeah. I could definitely relate to hiring people from, and I typically don't try to hire from like Google or Facebook or something like that. And maybe we miss some people, but it definitely, I think you, even if they talk the right talk and they're great at the interview and they have amazing references and all of that, like you just have so much support around you. It's just like some other person is like, you hand this off to the user researcher and they come back with a bunch of other feedback, or you just ask for like all of this data, like from the analytics team or whatever. And like everything, you just have so much support versus like, just figure the fucking thing out. Like you at a startup should be, and also like it's kind of a natural, and as you grow, like, there does become lines, and I'm continuously trying to like break down those barriers between teams. Like it's all of a sudden it's like, no, this is my team's, this is the other team's responsibility. It's like, no, just go and fucking do it. Like that's who you really want to hire for a startup, because you don't have any infrastructure. You don't have any of the tools. Even going through like fundraising and people, here's a great example. Like, if you're like a seed or series A company and you have like an investor that it's like, oh, can you get like the NRR based off of like this cohort of companies and this blah, blah, blah. It's like, I don't have the fucking resources to do that. Like, that's probably a bad example of an investor that probably is not going to invest in what you're doing, because they should know at what stage you have like these type of resources. Also, that kind of shit at that stage doesn't really matter. You should be really investing more in the team and like the initial idea and the traction, the iterations and all of that. But like you really, it's a stark difference from having all of the support, all of these different functions, versus like, you should just go and figure it out. I hope that, and maybe we can kind of end it on this. I hope that, AI, puts more power back into some people. We actually have, somebody from another company. One of their friends is an AE at some other startup, and he's put together like this crazy AI. I don't know what exactly. He's taken a bunch of transcripts from all of their existing calls and put it in something like this, and all of a sudden he's their top like performer, and he's gonna come and give us like a lunch and learn talk. But stuff like that. But like, that's an example of like a great, like scrappy, like startup person. It's like, they figured out all this shit on their own, and they're probably, and I think that they're actually gonna not tell the rest of the team, which is not totally a great, like, of their team, because they're just making, like, they're a salesperson, they're running on commissions, so they're just like raking it in, which may not be the best thing for the company, but like, that's what you need to fucking do as like a startup employee. And like, you need to look for people that have exhibited some sort of like curiosity or doing things that they're not asked for, even coming to the table with ideas about what you potentially could be doing something differently, and versus like trying to get people that have like been at Google or Facebook. And I think a lot of the mistakes, or even like other successful startups, you, for one, get people that are not used to doing a lot of stuff yourself, having a lot of infrastructure in place, but also you can equate like, oh, they were this position at this successful company. So you look at the success of that company and you apply it to this person, where it's like, they probably had like 0.01 like input into the success of that company, if that. So that's some hiring like mistakes that I've made before.
I agree. Like, I would much rather hire someone execution focused. And a lot of times at really large companies, like, you just can't execute over that much stuff. And like, you might get really blocked at a startup where you don't have people to help you with all those execution tasks. And I've definitely made that mistake as well.
Yeah, cool. You want to end on that?
Let's end it.
All right.
Great chatting this week.
Yeah, of course. Thanks everybody for listening. Reminder to rate, like, or whatever platform you're on. Send us comments about what you want us to dig into, any guests you think we should have on, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
See ya.